One of the questions I just got is, you know, is there a better way to do this? And especially anyone younger, my age or younger, we're just using everything online. Is there an app for this? Can I just do this at home? I'm paying money. No, we should have a workaround. It's 2024. I've got an iPhone 15. Well, the short answer is not really. And I shared with one of our brothers here about, hey, you know, there's three ways that attorneys are getting fees these days, right? Or any time you're doing estate planning. You're going to do it on the drafting side, right? You come in, we'll draft your trust package. You do it on the administration side. You know, you could, if somebody wants to appoint you, attorneys often serve as that successor trustee or to take care of some of these, administer trust and as a fiduciary. And so it's, you know, there's actually more money to be made there now. You just get a few big estates and you take a 1% a year, a couple hundred million estates, and you're making millions a year. And so most of my colleagues have migrated that way, which kind of creates this, you know, desert for drafting attorneys. But then you also get it on the contest side, right? So if you don't have a plan in place or it's poorly drafted or you do it yourself. And so the free wills and the NOLOs and the legal Zooms, and I've been through a bunch of them and I've talked to people on a bunch of them, because even when I'm doing the Barnabas Foundation side, we're trying to come up with a solution to avoid a formal, expensive sit down so that 67% try to move more people into doing some planning, even if it's triage. The problem is the product's pretty lousy on the back end because it's not like a turbo, even if you're doing like a TurboTax Q&A and I'm trying to file myself. This is a lot more complex in some levels in California, because what works in other states, I worked in Idaho for a couple years, a judge up there I met through Alliance Defending Freedom, had a wonderful time, but when it was up there, you bet, probate process is pretty easy, wills are more common than trust, and so off they go. And so I've talked to, we talked to the guys from Freewill, and when they were coming at us hard on the foundation, we bought a big package that would allow licenses to go out, and with a lot of direct links to a lot of ministries, so they could start selecting some gospel proclaiming ministries to get those resources out. The problem is the product was pretty lousy and it was abysmal here in California, because a lot of people came up with these trusts, and then you have the issue of trust funding as well. So I've actually never seen one. And so to the extent they're cutting in to my poor colleagues and may or may not get it on the drafting fees now, boy, are they going to get it on the contest fees on the back end. Because in addition to not having it done right, you didn't just prepare with the assistance of counsel. So now all of these claims of undue influence or coercion, or dad just didn't know what he was consenting to. Did he really do this? All these evidentiary functions that are accomplished by getting this done in your attorney's office are gone. If you were to say, oh, I don't think dad really knew what he was doing. Really? He went to a disinterested third-party attorney, of estate planner. We had the mobile notary there. Everything was kosher. You had two witnesses, and you've got a malpractice safety net undergirding that whole thing. So I think it's money well spent. And again, this is no dog in the hunt. I'm not taking clients, but I still think it's money well spent. So how much is that money well spent? Well, it depends. And any of you that ever talked to lawyers, it's always it depends. That's always the answer. But it really does. And so a lot of us, I was telling Grant anecdotally, but it's really true. Planning attorneys in California right now are kind of like toilet paper in 2020. You know, we're just unicorns. I mean, good luck. Because I just last week I was in La Jolla with an attorney CPA. It was a multi-day seminar on just advanced tax planning. And so we were sitting, we're all just burnt out. You know, we're just crushed. I mean, there's more, and they're just doing the projected numbers. Right now, we're doing about 34 every year, just based on this. We have 6,000 trust and estates attorneys in California. But then you've got, there's going to be over the next 10 to 11 million Californians are going to be dying over the next 10 years. And so you start looking at numbers, and we're expected to handle probably about 70 a year, and that's going to be, you start doing that by month. These things take a while to do them right. So maybe there'll be changes in legislation. Maybe there'll just be a huge bottleneck. I think it's going to be a big bottleneck like we see in other industries, nursing a few years ago, some other things. So the problem is prices, availability is way down, prices are way up. Because the ones that are left are just getting what they ask. I have a colleague I just talked to in Orange County, and this is non-attribution, but I'm just giving you my unvarnished Travis opinion. He's getting $1,200 an hour. A typical plan is $18,000 to $20,000. But that's in Orange County, right? He's also good at what he does, so his clients start at the $20 million estate value. But I'm also seeing years ago, you know, it was kind of you could maybe in the Central Valley you could get away with $1,000, $1,200, $1,500, maybe $2,000. You know, we're in an inflationary time with high demand, so you're probably going to pay a little more. But I'd like to think you can get out for under $3,000 if you just do those documents we talked about. I would expect that you'd be able to find someone. And again, if you guys know anyone, I don't work on any sort of fee or commission or referral, and so I do keep a list of names. I know a number of folks in California, brothers in Christ, who you know, will work in every county. They've got people that will be able to work in your clerk, you know, fund with your clerk recorder's office for your real property, and they try to keep their costs down. And there's because they're appreciate the charitable and the kind of the biblical stewardship worldview of the folks I send them. So I think, you know, by all means, I always appreciate feedback. If you and I'll be, you know, coordinating with, you know, Grant and anyone else who reaches out to me, because my assistant keeps an ongoing list of people that we just have names all over the country. You know, I'm one of a team of attorneys on this Barnabas Foundation. We're scattered across the country, and so we try to keep national coverage so that when a ministry or you know, donor reaches out to us, we can send them somewhere. So, but that's really a non-answer. But I'd like to think you could do a living trust package, those documents we talked about, for under $3,000. But don't quote me to that if you pay $4,000. Yes, sir.
Would you expect that same type of cost, like reviewing a will, let's say you did one 10, 20 years ago? Need to update it?
No, reviewing is a lot easier. So what do you do if you have a will? So most of you probably, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I don't embarrass anybody, but you know, numbers show most of you don't have a plan. So if you're doing your first one, yeah, you got to go through the wickets. What we're talking about here and getting thinking is actually going to save you a lot of time and could save you money, because again, there's a lot of fee structures. Some will go flat rate. They'll say, come on in, we'll do a consult, and I'll tell you what your flat rate's going to be. That was the way I did it. You know, let's talk about your stuff. Let's talk about how come. Let's talk about your family. And then on the back end, you know, I'll just quote you. So you don't have to worry about the clock running. You could call me. I'm happy to listen, you know, to you about your grandkids. And then you don't have to worry about me running the bill. But some will be hourly. And the ones that are hourly, if you come in, they're already having an idea of the things we talked about, you're going to save some money. But if you just need to do an update, to update a will, it's a codicil, or you can do just a full go null and void and just redraft. On the living trust, or like most trust, you're going to do either what's called an amendment or a restatement. Simple changes, update the beneficiary amount, do a swap out of that successor trustee, that's an amendment. Often those are a few $100, not bad. If you do a restatement, it's kind of like a start over, because you're just changing, you're doing a lot of major changes throughout. But remember, you know, once you fund in, remember my little basket graphic, once the trust owns your asset, like if your trust owns your house, it still owns your house at the Kern County Clerk Recorder's Office. So if you're like, I don't like this trust anymore, I'm going to throw it away, well, congrats, you just shredded the entity that owns your house. Now it can be dealt with, but you don't want to do that. So if you want to change everything, you just reference the original one, because your trust is going to have a date. So if you're, I'm sorry, I don't know names. Are you, sir? What's your name, sir?
Logan.
Logan and?
Rebecca.
So the Logan and Rebecca Trust of 18 July 2024, and then in 2034, they're like, you know what? Our kid's really just, oh, he's kind of stray, you know, let's go ahead and cut him out. And actually, you know what? I want to make some major changes. Well, they've got, you know, not just their house, but the, you know, the cabin at Tahoe and your house in La Jolla, all those other homes you own. And so he said, well, we're going to make some big changes. And so we're going to, you know, do a full restatement, but it's still going to reference that initial trust of 18 July 2024, because that's what Kern County and San Diego County and El Dorado County or Nevada County, that's what they, that's what those documents say. Okay, so when you make this trust, you can change it. It's revocable. You can revoke it. You could absolutely do it. But throwing it in the shredder is not a good idea, because if you actually funded it, now it owns assets. So don't destroy the document that owns your assets. All right, so yeah, so that's a long way of saying, yeah, you bet. You can make changes, and it's going to be cheaper. The more more changes you make, more expensive it gets. All right, one more question that I addressed during the break. I think it's good for the benefit of the group. You know, a lot of folks think, yeah, trusts kind of sound expensive. I think my kids will get along. But if your primary asset, like most Californians, is your home, then what do I do with that? Can I do something, you know, maybe just add a kid to the deed? You got to be careful with that. Okay, so if you're looking at saying, hey, maybe I'll just add a child to the deed or I'll do something, remember, you've got two bases in your real property. You've got a tax basis and you got a cost basis. So whatever property you own, your cost basis is going to determine your capital gains. You sell it, you may have a gain or a loss, usually a gain, right? The difference between your cost basis and that sale price is your gain or loss. Now you've got your tax basis. Most of us think about our assessed value or the recorder's office value. That's where you get your tax bill off of. That's what Prop 13 controls, and up till recently Props 58 and 193 that were repealed by Prop 19. So you've got that. When you're getting that bill from the assessor's office, that's going to be based on your tax basis. You try to add a kid to the deed, anytime there's an ownership change of 50% or more, then it's just going to trigger an automatic reassessment. So if you buy your house in the height of the Great Recession and it's gone up threefold in value, be careful about adding that kid to the deed. So one of the ways you can do that, that's one of the value of the living trust. It doesn't just avoid probate, it gives them flexibility. Because even in the wake of Prop 19, you can still go and have one of your kids, or if your kids predecease you, a grandkid, move into your house after death of surviving spouse. So you see, you had two people, and it's, you know, right of survivorship, you fund it into your trust, and then your trustee, maybe it's a kid, maybe it's a bank in trust, then now they're going to make a decision, because so long as one of your kids moves into that house, declares it as their primary residence within a year, and forfeits any other home as their primary residence for the tax basis, they get to keep your sweet tax basis running. So you buy your house in 1980 and it's gone up a bunch. Yeah, well, great. You buy your house, you know, in 20 years when you die, and the house you bought in 2010 has, you know, gone up fivefold in value, and you've got one kid or something, they get to move in and do it. The problem is, what I see oftentimes is a snapshot in time where I'm going to leave it to one child in 2024, and then you live to 2044, and then the circumstances have completely changed, and now when he says, well, let's try to give it to another sibling. Well, it doesn't work, because that's a post-death transfer. You forfeit that nice tax basis protection that's still preserved by Prop 13. So something to think about, but certainly living trust does more than just avoid probate. It gives a flexibility, because at that point, if your house is still your primary asset, you have multiple kids, it makes sense for one kid to move into that house. Well, whoever you appoint as your successor trustee gets to say, okay, fine, here's a fair market value based on an appraisal, buy your siblings out, and you get to keep that house and keep that sweet assessed level going. So you're going to keep that nice low tax bill that your parents, you know, picked up for you in the 90s. Make sense? So sometimes the planning, and certainly that's another reason to maybe avoid some of the commercial prepared software. Okay. Smart ways to give. This is what gets me up in the morning. So let's get through this, and I'll try to give you some time back. I'm just going to move through this because a lot of this isn't going to apply to a lot of you. But if it doesn't apply to you now, it may apply to someone in your circles, and it may or may apply to you at some point. So just bear with me. And if you're not thinking, well, this really doesn't apply to me, maybe think about somebody it might. Because what motivates me is to try to maximize the gifts. I mean, my going in position, and I hope it's shared across the room, is that Grace, you know, Grace Church of Bakersfield, TMAI, TMS, Grace to You, there can be a better steward of your resources than Sacramento or D.C. Okay, now if you don't believe, that's fine. I've had clients that want to pay tax. Oh, no, I want to pay my fair share. Okay, I will help you pay your fair share, but you know, I'd recommend you not. Now, I have some fun clients, but if you're going in position as admitted, your local church, sound ministry, are better stewards of resources than Sacramento or D.C., then let's talk about ways to maximize your gifts to ministry, maybe minimize some of those taxes. All right. So, the first one, for those of you with more as much sober more than me, if you're 70 and a half or older, you can do what's called a qualified charitable distribution out of your IRA. Okay, maybe you don't have an IRA, but maybe you have a 401k. Maybe you're still working. You still have an employer-sponsored 401k. Maybe you're a federal employee and you've got thrift savings plan. Maybe you've got your, you know, CalPERS. You've got some sort of CalPERS or some hybrid account that you can roll over into an IRA. If you have your traditional, funded with pre-tax dollars, IRA, When you take that required minimum distribution, which is now 73, 74 next year, you're going to be subject to ordinary income tax. It's going to be taxed at your tax bracket. You can take that required minimum distribution and give it all straight to a qualified charity, your church, whatever ministry you want, up to 100. Used to be 100. This year is now 105,000. Now it's indexed for inflation. So you could give over 100,000 a year right out of an IRA straight to charity. Charity doesn't pay tax on it. It checks the box for your RMD. It's a pretty good deal, and that's a great starting point. And it could be more than your RMD as well. If your RMD is 50,000, you could still give that 105. If you don't need the income out of the IRA, or you got a parent, or you got someone that you know that doesn't need the income, and they're coming up on 73 this year, and they're saying, "Oh, I got to take these required minimum distributions, and it's going to kill my tax brackets." Well, you could avoid it all. Just take it. If you don't need it, kick it straight to the church, straight to ministry, and you don't have to worry about it. So pretty good deal. Not some people know about those, probably not as many should. So QCDs, the person to contact about that would be your IRA custodian. So your Fidelity, Schwab, Vanguard, whoever's custodying, I'm just using IRS term, your IRA. Okay, and with the way the process works, the mechanics for that, if you guys aren't doing them, is most IRAs, a few years ago, these weren't very popular, weren't very known, but over the last several years, the IRA custodians, your Schwab's, Vanguard's, JP Morgan's, E-Trade, they got tired of getting calls from their account holders, so they're issuing now what's called IRA checkbooks. So they'll give you a checkbook, and you write a check like a checking account, give it to church, give it to ministry, tithe with it, whatever you want to do, but it's not the old rules about just get it in by December 31 and it counts for the year. If you want to satisfy out of that RMD, you need to write it, give it to the ministry, and ministry has to have it back to your IRA custodian before the end of the year to count. All right, so if you're going to do this, do it earlier in the year. Let's not wait till the holidays. Okay? That's one. Non-cash assets. This is a Travis favorite. So I'm just going to kind of talk about it just a little bit because Barnabas Foundation. When you think Barnabas Foundation, when I first heard about this ministry 10 years ago from a brother who was doing some ministry work and said, "Hey, there's this Barnabas Foundation. I know this guy. He works there. It's a great outfit. You should really talk to them." It's one of those calls you don't want to get because you feel like the Lord may be moving a different way in your life and you don't want to go that way because everything was going so well. Why would I? I'm not a nonprofit attorney. You out of your head? But after 2 years of saying no, I got convicted. Couldn't say no anymore, so I came on board. Well, Barnabas Foundation. Why is it Barnabas Foundation? Because the RM. When I think Barnabas, I think contention of Paul over the usefulness of John Mark, or I think about maybe these encouragements and all these various things. But remember, Barnabas had the piece of land that he took and laid down at the apostles' feet when he was saved. And what did what do we see? The Barnabas Foundation started in the mid-70s, so 50 years ago. It came out of the Christian Reformed Church and some of the Reformed circles in the North Midwest, Michigan, Illinois, Dakotas. And so a bunch of accountants and attorneys got together and said, "Hey, we may be land rich, cash poor. Is there a way we can actually avoid some of the cap gains? We're very high in those years. Avoid some of these death taxes with very low exemption amounts and actually get together and do some tax-wise giving." So Barnabas Foundation was formed. All right, so that's so gifts of real estate. Kind of front and center of what we do. I work with a number of ag interests and other folks within real estate portfolios in this area and all over the western states. I'm really just blessed to do this line of work because I get to learn a lot about dairies and growing nuts and oil and all kinds of fun stuff. But as I'm walking around, a lot of these guys have low or no basis in their properties. They've been in the family for years, they have an ag interest, some are daring, the kids don't want to get into dairy, what am I going to do with it if I sell it? California has the highest marginal capital gains rate in the nation, about 38.7% fed and state combined. So you're losing about 40%. If you have low basis, high appreciation, and a decent gift, it's going to, if you sell it, you're going to lose almost 40% of it. So what do they do? So, can we gift it? Yeah, you can absolutely gift that land. You can gift gift that your business or a percentage of that business or a percentage of that land straight to your church, straight to charity. And so these have become extremely popular, especially in the wake of Prop 19, because for those of you that may have some rental properties, you still have that nice favorable tax basis because you've owned it for a few years, but your kids aren't going to get it. Because if you didn't act before February 16th of 2022, then your kids aren't going to be able to take that nice, that sweet tax basis that we used to be able to preserve for real property. And so now you're saying, okay, what do I do with it? Well, you know, their kids will get the step-up basis, they'll sell it because their tax bill is going to go way up. Or if you want to start simplifying your estate during your life, less for your kids to deal with, then you could start doing some nice charitable gifts out of these. So a lot of people are rethinking. They had that real estate portfolio, they wanted to leave it to their kids, but now the tax bill is going to go up so much for your kids, it doesn't really make great sense to hold on to that as an asset class. So maybe you're looking at doing some gifting of real property. If that's not you, maybe somebody you know in your circle, that could be you. Feel free to send them away. I'm always happy to talk. Because here's the deal with that. You could give it outright, or you could give a portion of it. You get a deduction off your income taxes for the appraised value. And you're going to then avoid all the capital gains as well. So you get some tax savings on both ends. Income tax deduction, if you can use it, even if you can't use it all in year one. Remember, the IRS lets you carry forward your deductions for 5 years. And so you get a nice income tax deduction if you can use it, and you're avoiding that potentially 38.7% capital gains. So great gifts, okay? And that could be stock, real estate, business interest. Stock's very easy. If you've got, even if you're in your portfolio, it's like, I'd like to do some gifting, but, I'm a little, maybe you don't have the cash flow right now, but you bought NVIDIA, you're on IPO or something. And I mean, actually I have a wonderful client that I'm working with over near Monterey who's sitting on, bought a bunch of NVIDIA. Basis is $20 a share. And tens of millions of dollars worth of NVIDIA, and so it's kind of fun because she's giving some fun gifts these days, and it's fun to see because take that try selling it. You're going to pay through the nose on cap gains. Gift the stock outright to ministry. You get a deduction for the amount, and those are easy. Because the IRS says it's just going to be the mean between the open and close and the day's trade. And then you take a deduction for the amount you give. The charity doesn't pay any tax on the gift. So appreciated stock, appreciated real property, business interest. If you're sitting out here, maybe you have an LLC, limited liability company, an S corporation, family partnership. If you think, well, whether it's a sale or even just doing a gift, an anticipation of sale, even a small percentage gift to help wash a little bit of gain if you're going to sell, by all means, come talk to me. Okay. And even commodities. Last year, at the end of last year, someone delivered 1 million eggs to Barnabas Foundation. He said, here you go. I mean, we have relationships set up with auction houses for fruit processing and creameries and milk, all kinds of stuff. So you take an asset before you actually realize a taxable event, gift it to charity, figure out a way to get an appraisal that's going to form the basis of your deduction and avoid the gain. And I know I'm spending a lot of time on this slide, but this could be a transformational gift and often is for ministry. All right, so you give for less, not constrained by cash flow. We already talked about the deduction for fair value, and you gift instead of sell. All right, you could give it direct to a church or ministry. You could also use a donor advised fund. And who's heard of a donor advised fund? Does that mean anything to anybody here? I'm just curious. Very few people have. So here's the deal: donor advised fund. This really isn't just reserved for our retiree class, like those IRA qualified charitable distributions. Donor advised funds can be a really powerful giving tool, especially if you're kind of at or near on your income tax, because we've got a high standard deduction for income taxes right now, right? If you're married, you're filing, you're at $28,000. It's like, well, I'm giving $30,000 in a year total, but am I really going to itemize when I'm at or near that standard deduction anyway? Well, for a lot of folks, they love these donor advised funds now because you could give to a qualified charity in year one, and if you have the resources to do it, say, well, I'm going to give $60,000 in year one and take the standard deduction in year two, but then sprinkle out those gifts over 2 years flat. So the churches and the things I support still get those distributions at the same rate. So what does that actually look like? look like, well, then you've got the $60,000 you gave in year one that you're deducting, $30,000 you take the standard deduction in year two, and now you've got $90,000 worth of deduction off your income versus $60,000 had you just taken $30,000 over the 2 years. So it's a pretty powerful tool, and so if some folks even like it beyond just the bunchy giving for tax efficiencies, they also like it because it gives some legacy gifts as well. Because those things you give it, you set it in motion, and you could give over time. You could appoint successor advisors. I think we're all sensitive to ministry gifts. You know, there's some wonderful ministry, yesteryear ministries that are, maybe they got woke or whatever they're doing, they're not as effective in 2024 as they once were. So we're thinking, hey, maybe I'm supporting a ministry now, maybe I'm supporting a church now that could take a hard left turn or go a different way. How can we build it? Maybe I want to sprinkle out some gifts out of my estate or out of a sale of an asset or a gift of real property. Donor advised funds can check a box because you can take the full deduction and avoid the gain in year one, have it and have those resources held and invested, but sprinkle out the gifts during your life or as long into after God calls you home as you want. All right, by appointing a successor advisor, just setting something in autoplay. So donor advised funds, if you hear that, you may want to wrap your loving arms around it, because I think for a lot of folks, it makes really good sense. All right. And then finally, the life income gifts. Let's just talk about that. So let's say you have a house and you say, I'd really like to give, but I'm worried about my cash flow. I don't have a lot of income. I'm not independently wealthy. I've been doing some things, but I really am worried about long-term health care costs, and I'd like to realize some of the gain off the sale and then make a nice gift on the back end with it. And that's where some of these life income agreements can be pretty powerful. All right. So if you have a gift, and I'm just using, let's say an example, where do folks from Bakersfield go? Like Fresno, folks go up to Shaver and Bass Lake and such. What's your nearest lake where everybody wants a cabin to beat the heat in the summer? Pine Mountain maybe? Where do folks go from here? Pine Mountain? Maybe. Isn't that the place right over going toward the Grapevine? Anyway, let's say you have a house up there. What's that?
The beach.
The beach. All right, fair enough. You've got over in Cayucas. So you got a house in Cayucas, and you bought it a long time ago, and you spend your summers there, or you go in the spring to avoid allergies. And so I lived in San Luis for many, many years, and so I saw your neighbors come over in the allergy season. And so so you got your house in Cayucas or Cambria or San Simeon, and you've been going there for a long time, but you're getting a little old to travel, and so you say, I should probably do something with the house. But I bought it in 95 for $100,000, and now it's worth 1.5. So what do you do with it? Well, you could say, I'd like to do some gifting, but I could use a little bit of income, or I could like to realize some gain because it's long-term healthcare costs being what they are, and the certain future's uncertain. That's where these life income gifts can be really powerful, because what it allows you to do is take that asset, instead of just selling it, you could avoid the capital gains by giving it to a charity to create a trust for you that's going to kick you out to life income. And if you're married, it's called a two-life vehicle, so it could be what's usually called a CRUD, a charitable remainder unit trust, that will then kick out quarterly payments up until the death of the surviving spouse. And then whatever's left in there is going to go to the charities that you pre-selected during life. So it's a pretty fun tool. Not too many people know about them. I wish more people did, which is why I'm standing up here tonight. Because if you do have, and it could be house, it could be stock, it could be whatever. If you have these appreciated assets we talked about a couple slides back, and you say, I'd really like to gift, but I'd really like to be able to realize something from the gain, because we're going to need a little more in retirement than the IRA is going to provide, or we got a lot of market uncertainty, and so I'd like to get something out of it. These charitable remainder trusts and charitable gift annuities, those two at the bottom, are pretty powerful tools. One's an annuity, it pays a fixed amount and it's funded with cash or stock. The other one's a unit trust and it pays a fixed percentage, say a flat percentage out of the trust assets every year based on the value there. So it's kind of cool. So you avoid the capital gain when you put it in. You take a deduction for a part of the gift, not the whole thing, because you have a retained interest in the distributions, and then you end up getting a cash flow up until your death, or if you're married, death of surviving spouse. So something to think about. I'm just kind of talking. There's actually a couple of those handouts, I think, in the folders before you. One's on that CGA, that charitable gift annuity, and one's on that CRUT. And so you're thinking, hey, you know what? This may be a good fit for me. Feel free. Give me a call. I'm always happy to chat. Life income gifts, we already talked about. And then gifts from a trust or will, obviously pretty straightforward. Going to leave a percentage of your estate. All right, something to think about is, like we talked about, these can be transformational gifts. They can outgive everything you've given during life, and often I see that. All right, and it can extend giving beyond your lifetime as well. You don't have to give it all in year one. If you do it through a will, it's going all in year one. But if you have it through a trust or a donor advised fund, you can sprinkle out those gifts for a number of years. It's for budgeting. I mean, we've all been part of. I'm on the board of a couple nonprofits. I'm involved with. I try to help out some church leadership from time to time, and so we've all had those conversations. We get that nice gift out of an estate. You get almost that transformational gift. You know, it's like wow. And then you get you kind of get these teams divided into thirds. One third wants to put it all away for a rainy day. You know, we got to be fickle. One third wants to give it all to missions, and oh, this is great. Let's just kick it all out to missions today. And then the other one is, you know, some form of a capital improvement. You know, no, we could finally build out. You know, we've been talking about it. We could buy the neighboring lot. We could do it. So, and I'm not saying there's a right answer there, and I'm not weighing in, but when you get these nice large gifts, sometimes they can make a little bit of hand wringing within the recipient. So, sprinkling that out to allow for budgeting over a period of years may make sense, depending on who you're giving to. If you're giving to a nice, healthy church like Grace of Bakersfield, you're going to be fine. But a lot of the smaller ministries or some of these smaller missions groups, it's like, well, I'd like to give, but if I were to leave them as much as I'd like in year one, I'm worried it's just going to wreak havoc for the budgeting process. So extending that beyond, I think, can be important. So certainly think about that. So what does that actually look like? Here's what I see commonly. So if you're thinking, you know what, yeah, you're right, Travis. I've modeled some giving for my kids during my life. I certainly want to continue that out of my estate. But how much, right? I mean, do I really want to give like half? How much do I have? How much do my kids need? Remember my red bullet point? You know, at some point, too much is going to hurt more than help. But once you figure that out in prayerful consideration, you may want to say, okay, well, do we give a tithe out of our estate? Maybe we do, 10% or some other amount you're going to call your tithe. Well, a child named Charity is a common distribution that I've seen a lot in the last maybe 10 or 12 years where people will say, okay, I've got three kids, but I want to cut my estate up into quarters, and then my kids will each get the 25%, and then I'm going to do a 25% distribution that's going to be split up between church and ministry. And so that child named Charity, that charitable share, comes in. So you have three kids, you split into four, you have two kids, split into three. And I think most people, like me, I've got three kids. You know, the difference between three equal shares and four equal shares is, 8 1/3%, 25 or 33 and a third. So the difference isn't enough to really make a difference in my kids' lives, but I could really leave some nice gifts for ministry. So something to think about. Some other percentage. Every now and again, I have some folks that are so generous, I have to almost try to maybe just get them thinking to throttle back. You know, they really, oh, I just want to give all my kids get $50 and everything else is going to the ministry. It's like, all right, do you dislike your kids? There's something going on. And, you know, it's like, well, I mean, or do they at least know that that's your spirit? Do they know that that was the Lord leading? Having those family meetings on the front end. If you're one of those givers and you're just, guy, just everything's going to ministry, that's great. Bless you, brother or sister. But please, hear me now, remember me later. Talk to your kids. Let them know, hey, guys, I love you. I really do. But I just feel like I've been led to give it. You guys are fine. God's really taking care of you. He's providing. I don't want to disincentivize you from work. And I also want to really just bless the church or ministry, okay? So have those conversations, because I've had a lot of conversations with kids. They're like, well, did you ever get any reason? Was mom mad at me? No. I believe she loved you. She never said so. But, she loved her church. The other is a reduced to zero clause, and so there may be within the room, there could be an ultra high worth individual in here. I recently drafted, and so there are this is a a clause that a couple of us draft for the charitably minded. So your taxable estates, that's the estate tax. If you're north of that, you know, now 27, 28 million, I recently drafted clients, a couple hundred million estate, and they said, look, you know, right now with estate values at about 26, 27 million, we've got our three kids. You know, if we're going to give our three kids about 9 million apiece, that's more than enough. But we don't know because it's adjusted for inflation. So even if that goes down to 14 million, 7 million apiece with portability, that's still more than enough. They're going to get a few million apiece, whether that's, you know, 3 million or 9 million, depending on what that exemption amount. I just do not want to pay that aggressive 40% death tax. Okay. So they said, not knowing with that estate tax, we'll just do a, you could do a reduced to zero clause. Whatever that exemption amount is, anything beyond that that's going to be subject to estate taxes is going to ministry, and you're going to avoid all of it. So you empower your successor trustee. So that's what I call a reduced to zero clause, and some of my colleagues do too. Okay. And looks like I just have a couple slides. So I think this last bullet is important. Whether you're ultra high worth, maybe some of this doesn't apply to you. Maybe you don't have kids. Maybe you're not worried about child and charity. But when you're doing planning, we really need to be thinking total estate, whether it's distribution to kids or distribution to your family. Because there's a lot of assets. Remember we talked about the trust assets, and I'm talking about these funding issues. What's in the basket? Did you put in the basket? You got the probate asset. What's the court going to do? Or is it those pour over wells because now they're probate assets because of failure to fund? Or those beneficiary designations. Some beneficiary designations may make sense just to move it to your trust. Some beneficiary designations may make sense to move it to individuals. This really depends. But if you're thinking about your estate and thinking, you know what, I think that child named charity. So say, for example, yeah, Travis, remember that child named charity you were talking about? I like that. Let's do that. I want to give about a quarter percent of our, you know, quarter of our estate to ministry and church, and I want to give, you know, 25% to the kids. Okay, that's great. And so you draft it up, maybe draft it in a will or a trust, but that's only a small percentage or a percentage of your estate. So say, for example, your estate consists of a couple IRAs because you maybe had dual income, or maybe you had jump jobs. You've got, you've got some life insurance as part of that. You've got a couple investments. You've got a brokerage account. You've got some other accounts that you have your beneficiary designation on. So your trust assets may include your house, may include your tangible personal property, maybe a couple other things. But then you've got all these other things over here. So in your trust, you're saying, okay, let's give a quarter of everything to ministry, and then everything else to the kids. Well, if your kids are all the beneficiaries, so a surviving spouse, you know, spouse, and then to kids in equal shares, if your kids are the beneficiaries, and that represents, say, 50, 60, 70% of your estate, and you're doing a quarter interest out of your trust, thinking you're doing a quarter of your entire estate to ministry, that's going to be about a quarter of the value of your house, and not a quarter of your total estate. So when you're thinking about these things, it may make sense to actually run all of these beneficiary designations into your trust, and then use that as a central clearinghouse to kick out. And there's a conversation about whether it makes sense to fund IRAs into a trust, and tax, because especially traditional, you can. It's called a C3 trust. You know, feel free to. I'm happy to talk to you if you're thinking IRAs. If you like this, come and talk to me. I can give you some language. But there's some ways to do this. Okay. But in any event, you're thinking total estate, everything you have that's going to be going out to your kids and to ministry. It's not just the stuff listed in your will. You're not saying, oh, I'm giving it half. To whatever, and it's put in your will. You put it in your trust because you've got a lot of stuff that may not pass through a will or trust. All right. So finally, this is the last substantive slide. We really need to think about giving during life. In my mind, I firewall it between gifts during life and gifts during death. Okay, gifts from your estate, gifts during life. So gifts during life are going to be those donor advised fund. Okay, but that can kind of go into death as well if you wanted to. And gifts from your IRA is going to be that QCD, that qualified charitable distribution. Those non-cash gifts, or if you fund one of those charitable remainder trust charitable gift annuities. Okay, so those are going to be things that you do during life. And then gifts from your estate, when you're thinking, okay, we talked about that total estate, but not all of your assets. And hear me now, remember me later. Not all of your assets are created equal for your distributions to kids and to charity. Not all of your assets are created equal for distributions to kids and distributions to charity. What do I mean? There's this thing called a step up in basis. If you die, And you buy, you buy your house and $2,000 for $100,000. When you die, it's worth $1 million. And you leave it to your kids. Well, congrats. Real property, any real property, even investment property, will get a step up in basis to the fair market, for cost basis, not tax, to the fair market value of the date of death of surviving spouse or surviving trustee, if whoever's on that deed. So if you get that thing sold shortly after, your kids take the proceeds free and clear of the cap gains. Pretty good deal. Say, for example, in your state you have an IRA or 401k, and then you have an inheritance. So you have a spouse that takes your spouse is the first person to get your IRA. That's called a spousal rollover. Your spouse gets to take it and continue to do those recomputes the RMD, but they can continue to take those distributions based on their life expectancy. That those RMDs are computed by the balance and the age based on the IRS's mortality tables. So the spousal rollovers are great. But if you leave them to your kids and they're over 18 and it's an inherited IRA, and those inherited IRAs now in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act have to be paid out within 10 years. They used to have a stretch election that was allowed up until 2018 when you could actually pay out for the kids' mortality. But those are taxes, ordinary income. So you dump an IRA onto the kids, most a lot of that is going to be lost in tax because it's under compressed distribution schedule, tax is ordinary income. You'll leave those to charity, charity takes them tax-free. You'll leave the house to your kids, they get a step up in basis, they take the proceeds to tax-free, avoiding all cap gains. So, and then there are a lot of things. So if you have cash, a checking account, you have 100% basis in cash, they take that, they're not subject to tax unless you're doing estate taxes. So when you're looking at all your stuff, not all of your stuff is created equally for distributions. Some things make sense for your kids to get, some things make sense for ministry, to get your church or ministry. And so kind of separating those out, you know, sometimes requires the assistance of counsel, but at a minimum, you know, your big assets, your retirement accounts with your tax-deferred, not your Roths, I'm talking about your traditional IRAs, your 401ks. If you have a tax-deferred that's going to be subject to ordinary income tax, those are usually the starting point for your charitable gifts. And if you were to put the beneficiary designation to a charity, that's one way, but maybe that balance is way up or way down. And if we're trying to do kind of a percentage of our total estate, how does that work? Well, you can kick it into your trust, have it as a see-through trust, let your successor trustee figure out the balances of everything you got, balances of your real property, balances of your IRAs, balances of your investment accounts, balance of everything else, then make those distributions. But they have the flexibility then to start with those IRAs and kick those out to charity. And if those don't cover the your 25% gift, say, then they could take from somewhere else to kind of top off. But at least you're doing that tax-efficient gift first. Because sometimes those beneficiary designations where you're leaving gifts out of your trust to charity or church, but that's your trust is funded primarily with real property, where you're taking things that your kids could get a step up in basis and then giving them a beneficiary designation on an IRA where they're going to be taxed on their income. So, something to think about. And then successor advisors, we talked about, you know, I think we're all sensitive to ministry drift. And so you could, through a donor advised fund or through an express trust, you could actually get a tail on your gift. And I just encourage you to pray, evaluate your current plan. If any, maybe you're due for an update. Consult with your advisors, you know, certainly local attorney, like we talked about, it could try to get you, you know, grant and I can, and, you know, leadership can put our heads together and then discuss maybe giving opportunities with the church or ministry legacy team. Now, I think leaning into the space, and that's what I love about my position here, is I can come without a dog in the hand and say, look, you know, I would just encourage you to think about estate gifts to your church. You know, most people don't. It's been a blind spot. It was a blind spot for me up until I got into this line of work a couple decades ago. You know, it's really just thinking about, hey, you know what? Yeah, of course I'm a faithful tither. Well, you know what? The Lord's really blessed your estate during your life. And when you're thinking about distribution out of your estate, you have an opportunity to really bless this church and keep its doors open. Because if you think that maybe the Gen Z doesn't share the giving patterns of the silent or greatest or boomer generation, which they don't, I'll tell you, I've seen a lot of charts. If you don't think they're going to be as organizational, church loyal, if you think they're going to go after the crowdfunding and the hard stories and go through the GoFundMes and not do the actual, the regular tithing as much, which you're right, then maybe you want to think about an estate gift to try to keep the revenue flows and keep this ministry going. Keep this church in Bakersfield doors open as long as possible. So, anyway, but again, to circle back, I can't care about your state more than you. I'm here to warn, and I absolve myself of that responsibility. And so with that, I will subject myself to questions. If none, back over to you, Grant.
I have a mechanics question for you. So I'm a little confused about how I understand the funding of the trust. I have a trust. So, and I have all of my 401ks and everything. Everything funds the trust. So I have children, so everything goes to the trust, so they're taken care of. And I get the giving, but I'm not quite sure I understand the mechanics of how the trustee would say, okay, take these, because the IRA or the 401k is going to pay to the trust. So how do they take care of the tax advantage? Because the trust is going to file a 1041,
right? Yeah.
So I'm just kind of curious, how does the trust take advantage of giving to outside of just a normal tax deduction?
Yeah, because there's not a realization event if your trust is drafted the right way to be a see-through trust. There's that little term I threw in there, and I really don't want to kind of bog down in the weeds. We're kind of talking about but here's the deal. And that when I talked about a see-through trust, the IRS says if you have discernible beneficiaries and you have the appropriate language to make it a qualified see-through trust, then when that IRA, your 401k or IRA, hits your trust, it's not a taxable event. So it's a do not pass go and goes through. The trustee can direct that straight to the beneficiary, your charity, and then it goes straight to charity without paying tax along the way. So instead of actually paying the trust accounting, because now it's income realized by your trust and then out, yeah, that is one way, but you could if you could make it a qualified see-through trust, you can actually avoid it. So it's not a taxable event. It just passes through your trust on its way to the beneficiary. So the trust is a beneficiary, but it's just really the beneficiary to direct the ultimate beneficiary. And so no tax here. That's why it's called a see-through, because you could see through to the trust to the ultimate beneficiary. So yeah, it's just so maybe it's worth looking into more often than not, unless you've jumped on LegalZoom or something, you've got you probably are a qualified see-through trust. Another reason to not use LegalZoom. Yeah, but it may be worth, you know, but look at the language or just call your attorney and say, hey, I just want to make sure that you know, if we're doing some kingdom giving. Anything else? Yes, sir.
Well, this is all kind of brand new to me, but if you set up a living trust in one state and then move, what happens to the status of that living trust? What if you die in a different state?
Yeah, redo it? Great questions. Oftentimes you don't. And so, a lot of folks, especially if you move to a Western state, you take a California trust, you move to another state, you can just do an amendment or a restatement, and you just usually do a situs update, which is just your location. So instead of saying, and a lot of trusts, you'll see, some of them will say, you know, this is subject to the laws of the state of California. A lot of them are just silent with respect to a state, too. And so you get there, you just establish, more often than not, if you're in Colorado or Arizona, New Mexico, Idaho, or wherever you go. Now, I did have one, I got a call yesterday from Louisiana. No one in this room move to Louisiana if you have a plan in place, because they're like this holdout French civil law. They wouldn't touch. Someone moved there with a California trust, and they wouldn't even talk to this poor lady. And so it's just an interesting state. But for most states, yeah, if you were to move there, yeah, I mean, it's really case by case. You know, it depends. But most Western states, you have trust recognition, and so it depends. Now, what often happens, though, is, you know, you retain some real property interest in California. You buy a home there. Maybe you buy something else there, and as you're starting to, like a lot of our friends and neighbors, of course, we've all seen it as people are moving to other states in retirement or just, you know, for whatever reason, bailing out of California. And so if you keep assets here and you have some cross-border transactions, having it all in one trust works usually for administration, but you need to be thinking maybe about taxes, because one of the things too, there's these non-funded grantor trust and intentionally effective grantor trust and all these various things you can do to try to avoid any realization on capital gains if it ends up ultimately being administered in another state. So trying to get, now real property, good luck, but other assets, if you have investment accounts, maybe set them up here. California wants a claim to them. There's some ways you can try to move them out. So if you do, yeah, do a sit down with a planning attorney in that jurisdiction. But the trust itself usually isn't tossed, because again, it owns whatever you have here in California. Often it's just amended, and then you just continue to fund it with new acquisitions. So, yes, sir.
How does something like life insurance work with a trust?
Yeah, great question. So life insurance is typically, I mean, there's term and there's whole and there's all these crazy hybrids. But the if you typically are going to have a beneficiary designation, and typically it's not going to be subject to tax. So like your whole life insurance, so you have $1 million policy and you leave it. You could go completely outside the trust. And then, and most people do. The beneficiary, it's going to be your spouse, maybe surviving kids. The trust could get involved, like we talked about on the with those 401ks. If you're saying, okay, you know, but I want to do some charitable, I want to do some kingdom giving out of my trust, but my life insurance is going to be, say I've got a $100,000 life insurance policy, and then I've got all my other assets here for nice round numbers. I got 900,000 of assets over here, and so I want to, and I'm doing a, you know, a 10% tithe out of an estate. So where's that going to be coming from? Well, maybe that maybe it just makes sense to keep the life insurance out of the state. But I think if you're looking at trying to just approximate percentages for family or kids and to church and ministry, funding it into your trust and en route to your beneficiaries may make sense. So making the beneficiary, so if you have a trust, oftentimes making the trust a beneficiary of that life insurance policy and then allowing your successor trustee to distribute those funds based on, you know, where you're kicking them out of your trust. So you don't have to, though. Some people just leave them out. Some people try to do everything with beneficiary designation because, you know, just that concept of a trust is, you know, a little bit hard to wrap your head around. And so, but I know I could kick this here and this here and this here. And so I'll do. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just I think I like the idea of a living trust as being a little bit of that, you know, central, you know, clearinghouse, kind of the belly button, the conduit of all your giving, because it allows you to get the kind of wrap, let your successor trustee, the person administering your estate, be able to wrap their arms around all your assets and then kick out on the percentages.
Would you need, sorry, just a quick follow-up, would you need a will to like manage your what you want to happen with the money from the insurance, right? Like, let's say me and my spouse died and I wanted to go a certain direction, would that be a will, or would the trust define where that money goes, or you just have to trust?
Yeah, yes. So if it's a simple will, you just have a straight beneficiary designation, and then it would just be given lump sum. And it's all administered because you have an affidavit, the beneficiaries get their payment out, and that's it. If you're thinking, you know, I'd really like to get an idea. So I work with a number of folks that say, hey, I want to get my kids involved in giving. You know, I hear a lot about the joy of giving. I really discovered it too late in life. You know, the Lord's really blessed me with my, and I wish I discovered the joy of living, and I really want to get my kids or my grandkids or great-grandkids involved in giving, and so I want to set up. So they'll set up maybe a donor advised fund for them, or they'll leave them in a state gift, and they say, well, you know, I'd like you, I can't even use the estate deduction, so I'll give it to you outright, but it's my desire that you use it and maybe gift a percentage to these various ministries. So you can say, all right, there's a number of ways you can do that. You can either say, hey, I hope that you give it to a Bible-believing ministry or a Bible-believing church like Grace, but, you know, I don't know, let's just hope for the best and expect the worst. Or you can put some guardrails on that. To put the guardrails on it, you can't really do it through a will, because that's just an in and out, you're kicking it off to the beneficiary. If you do a trust, you could either do it through a trust, it's going to kick on for now, you know, continue to, you know, distribute and manage resources for a number, however many years you set after you're gone, and then you can put guardrails. You know, I want my kids to get involved, you know, they're going to get these benefits, and I want them to be able to make some decisions about where these this is going for kingdom gifts. But, you know, you could pick between these, you know, these four ministries, and they all have to start with Grace. I mean, you know, I don't know, Grace to you, Grace to you, Grace Community Church, Grace Bible Church of Bakersfield, or the TMAI. I mean, you know, so pick a ministry. So you can put some guardrails on it. I work with a number of folks that say, you know, I want to do it for Bible translation. I like to do it for, you know, missions or whatever the Lord leads. You know, it's fun for me because I just get to, you know, talk to people about what the Lord's laid on their hearts. But so, yeah, but that's the short answer is, yeah, a well is an in and out. You could do it through a donor advised fund or through a trust. Have somebody else be a successor advisor. So really beyond you, where it's going to go, you could put the conditions. You could say, I want it to pay out for no more than 10 years because I'm not looking to create a perpetual endowment. I want to get these resources deployed for kingdom work, but I also want it to be sprinkled out over time instead of just all pumped in year one. So you've got a lot of options, but if you're going to put a tail in post-death, you know, stream of income, it's usually going to be through either a trust or through using a charitable donor advised fund.
Don't you think it also, I mean, for me, we've seen that it definitely changed from when our kids were younger. Now my kids are teenagers, two are now over 18. So for me, I'm seeing it change that I need to go back in and revise because my goal with my wife and I was that if we our demise, the trust would take care of the kids and that they would have monies and so forth, and the trust was lined out so that they could get to college if the money existed and so forth. And now that they're getting older, I'm already seeing, like, okay, I need to change this up. I want to do more giving. I mean, we already had provisions in there. But now I'm like, okay, I need to think differently. I got some different goals now. You know, we'll see if they get any money or not.
Right.
You know, I mean, love them, but I'm like, hey, you're going to be self-sufficient because your mother will turn over to grave. You know. Yeah. But I definitely, yeah, I mean, I saw after 7 or 8 years, we began to make changes. We were more, like, we had provisions for college, and I put in provisions that, like, I want those colleges reviewed because I didn't I wasn't going to pay for a woke college even in my death.
Right. Yeah, no, so that's great. No, great point. And so there's a whole, you know, we could spend a little bit of time talking about, and I could stand up here for a week. But when to update is a great question. You know, certainly situation, you know, asset level change, family dynamics change, health challenges, marriage, divorce, substance abuse, special needs. There's a number of triggering events. So even if you have a plan in place, when do you update it? I could spend a lot of time also talking about family meetings and letters of instruction. You know, that I alluded to a little bit, let your kids know you love them, even if you're very charitably minded. But the family meetings, hearing it, you know, most people respect, even if they think, Mom, even if they think you're crazy, your kids are typically going to respect your where you want your gifts to go. But oftentimes, too often, I'm afraid, they'll fight like mad if they're left guessing. I mean, if you say, hey, I want it to all go to the you know, the homeless guy on the street, it's like, okay, I think, you know, Dad was off his rocker, but that's what Dad wants, that's what Dad gets. But if there was some uncertainty because you last did it in the 80s and they were kids and now you're saying, okay, now what do we do? Then it's going to be left guessing. So having a family meeting, hearing it from your mouth about, hey, this is what I want, and then they're going to usually honor wishes even if they don't agree with them most of the time. But you're absolutely right. So there's kind of three stages in which most of us that are doing the drafting side kind of get their clients. You get it when you get the key, usually about the time your second kid comes into the world. And I don't know why, it's always a second. And so you say, oh, you know what? What if something happens to us? We should probably get something in place. Okay, so it's a minor kids, all right? So some of you are the minor kids phase. Then you blink three times and your kids are up and out, and then they're out of college and they're kind of working, and it's like, yeah, you know, we haven't done that in 15, 20 years. Now we should probably do that. You know, actually our kind of asset level is growing. I guess we acquired a couple things, and the guardians, actually, you know, we're not too worried about. So maybe we're probably time for an update, all right? So somewhere in your 30s and 40s, early mid-40s, then somewhere again about 60 to 65, you sometimes, you know, we'll see you. But if you miss that 60 to 65 window, oh boy, am I going to see you again between 75 and 90. Because then you're going to sit there and realize that, hey, you know what, this thing is so stale and out of date. Asset levels have changed. Kids have changed. Everything we put in place has changed. And the kids are set up. They're doing just fine. We got grandkids into the room. That equal shares distribution that most people do. Okay, let's just get everything to the kids, and you know, we're going to have a trustee for the kids' assets and the trustee of their persons by way of the guardians when they're minors, and then you know, we're going to say everything to the kids to make sure that they can get through college and get a home, and then when they've gone through college and when they have a home and then they're making more than you are, and you're like, okay, now what do I do? Well, now I want to do some charitable giving. And so then you kind of pivot hard for the kingdom giving, and you know, that's like we just heard a little bit. And so yeah, absolutely, you know, kind of re-racking and stacking, and then you've got a lot of options. We talked about it too. Not all your assets are created equally, and lifetime gifts. I think right now a lot of Christians in America, or the West in particular, you know, are troubled by the events over the last few years. And they had a long-term plan. Okay, yeah, we'll leave some gifts out of the estate, maybe leave some things, but there's a sense of urgency. And I love to see it. And so they're stepping up and saying, you know what, the kids are fine. And we've got a lot more. When we actually sit down and look at our whole estate, we got a lot more than we thought. You know, maybe it's time to give a little bit, but not just writing checks. For most Americans, writing checks out of your checks book is not the most tax-efficient way to give. giving from appreciated stock, giving from the business, if you, even if you have some, identify some appreciated stock. You have 100% cash basis in your cash. Keep your cash. Leave it for the kids. You know, give stock. Avoid the gain. Take the deduction, you know, at a minimum. If you have real estate, even better. So there's a lot of things you can do. And then there's kind of the sub-third category. It's the fourth category. And please, I hope it's not you, but it, I mean, I'm kind of wasting my breath even saying it. Then there's a teetering diminished capacity. And about 40% on average of my clients within the last 2 years of their life are going to come to me with a radical change to their plan. And I'm like, okay, there's something, just something flipped. A kid got to them. They're just not thinking clear. But they still have capacity because in California, the bar is low. Most states, the bar is low. But they want to make a radical change. They've spent their entire life. They love the Master Seminary. They love TMU. They've been supporting it. And then something within the last 24 months before death, they just, something flips. And they're like, oh, I just want to give it 100% to you. And it's like, all right, well, hold on. Let's talk. So I do my best to try to talk them off the ledge. But if they have capacity, they have capacity. So please, I hope that's not you. Remember, if you feel like you're, you know, you have one foot on the grave and the other on a banana peel, now's not the time to decide you suddenly love a lot of new ministries that you've never given to before. So there's some safeguards you could even do because most of us will have incapacity at some point and actually kind of triggering where you're only making gifts. You could say only gifts that I've given, ministries that I've given to within the last 5 years before my death or 10 years before my death. Because with some of the, yeah, sometimes it's, you know, triggering an incapacity declaration through a physician or family friend you trust to kind of be able to put in guardrails for yourself so you just don't cut out a wonderful ministry, you know, that you've been had. It's been in your state for 20, 30 years, and then, you know, within your last, you know, 6 months, you just, there's this prosperity church next door. You got the sign confusion, you know, I want to give it to those guys. All right, so please don't do that. All right, thank you very much. And I will be staying around after.